Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Well, coming up, we're going to hear about an upcoming celebration of the music of the civil rights movement. And later, we'll hear about a new movement that takes a radically different view of federal spending and the federal deficit. The movement believes that higher levels of federal spending are possible without injuring the economy. That's coming up in a few minutes. But first, one listener commented about yesterday's program. Yesterday, for part of the show, we discussed the anti-government protests in Iran. Here's what one listener had to say following yesterday's show.
This is James calling from Sarasota. I saw a statement from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu supporting the human rights and freedom for the Iranian protesters. I find that to be very ironic. What about freedom and human rights for the Palestinians living in Israel, in the occupied territories, and in Gaza?
Well, that was a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. That's from 1959. That's a group called the Harmonizing Four. The song is I Shall Not Be Moved, which was one of the standards of the civil rights movement. And we're going to talk with September Penn and Ivan Penn. September is the author of the play The Sounds of the Civil Rights Movement, The Power of Song 2017. And it's going to be staged at the Palladium Theater this coming January 8th and 9th. And September Penn and Ivan Penn, welcome to WMNF. Great to see you again.
Great to see you, too. Thank you so much for having us back.
Did I get those days right?
The 7th and the 8th.
7th and 8th. Okay, so the 7th is... thank you for that, and I'm sorry I got the dates wrong.
That's okay.
January 7th and 8th, that's this weekend.
That's right.
At the Palladium in downtown St. Petersburg. And welcome back to WMNF. And September, tell us about the play, The Sounds of the Civil Rights Movement, The Power of Song. How long have you been doing it?
This is our fourth year. So we're pretty excited about that. We actually received the call and the commission back in 2014 to create an original production that talks about the music of the civil rights movement. I saw it as a divine assignment. I was so pleased to take it on, and we had the first show January 2015. So this is pretty cool. Here we are at January 2018. We're still going strong. We still have some veteran cast members who have been with us since day one. We've also had some new people join us. So we're excited. And we basically give history lessons. We talk about the songs that were used in the civil rights movement that helped to keep it alive, helped to drive it forward. We go over all the standards, and we talk about how many of them came out of the black church. And for some of the songs, we specifically will talk about the author. What happened to this artist? What was the situation that prompted this song? You know, what ignited this passion that, you know, created this type of song that still has lasting power? So that's what we're sharing, history lessons. One announcer has actually dubbed it edutainment. So it's educating, obviously. There's an education that you receive there, but you will certainly be entertained as well.
And September, that song that we just heard, I Shall Not Be Moved, that song has a long history. It was used in the civil rights movement, but its history goes back further, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, it was born in the black church. And it was, and the version that you have, there's so many versions of these songs, which is so beautiful. Every artist, they take the song and they put their own spin on it. But the one that you have is probably at its, I would say the more pure a version, because they didn't even switch the lyric to the weed. It's still on the I. And the focus is, I shall not be moved out of the church because of my faith in Jesus Christ. So when they took the song and used it in the movement, they flipped it to, we shall not be moved collectively. We shall not be moved off of our fight. We shall not be moved or deterred from what we're seeking, what we're going after, that type of deal.
And why were songs important to the civil rights movement?
Well, the songs were very important because with Martin Luther King being the chosen leader, he chose to be nonviolent. And if you're not going to use weapons, you know, no weaponry for ammunition, you need something to use, something that will unite the people, something that will stir the people. Many times in their rallies, even when they're just encouraging each other, it's a song that will do it. The song helps them to emote. It helps them to connect. When they're actually out there protesting and marching and people are getting tired and weary, sometimes a song. You know, we even think about work songs all the way back to slavery days in the fields. That's where so much of this was born. Those work songs helped them to get through that whole field.
Even if you're not religious, the songs there's an energy to songs, a song that can bring a group together and give you courage.
Exactly. The song, it's just a beautiful unifying factor. And the thing about the music is, even if you're not religious, even if you're of a different culture, even if you don't speak the language, it's the song and the vibrations, the energy that comes through the music that helps to bond us, that helps to bring us together.
Well, we're talking about the play, The Sounds of the Civil Rights Movement, The Power of Song. It's going to be performed this coming weekend at the Palladium, January 7th and 8th at 7 o'clock, and two people involved with it. The author of the play, September Penn, is here. Ivan Penn is here, too. And Ivan, this play has gone a lot of places, been performed a lot of places around the country, right?
Well, we took it to California in February, and that was the actual first national performance of a production born right here in St. Petersburg. And
we should say both of you used to live here in St. Pete, and now you're living in Southern California, sunny Southern California.
That's yes. Right. But our nonprofit is based here in St. Pete, the Power of Song Incorporated, and we now have an affiliate there in Southern California, but the parent company is here, and this production is the flagship. September mentioned the commission that we received in 2014. It was from St. Pete College. This production serves as the official kickoff event for the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day of Service for St. Petersburg. And Senator Daryl Roussan helped to really bring all of this effort together for the Day of Service. And so we're working to inspire nonviolence, but also community service and mentoring of young people.
I want to ask you about that nonviolence in a moment, but I also want to bring on another guest. He's Steve Yamaguchi, and Steve's mom was interned in a concentration camp, a Japanese internment camp during World War II. But before we do that, September, every year you update this play since you've been doing it in 2015. This year,
yes,
there's a new focus. A lot of the focus is still on the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, but you've added another dimension.
Yes. Well, it has to do with, obviously, the bulk of the production talks about the music of the civil rights movement, and you're going to hear all of this great music that will certainly move you. But I always want to bring it up to date to what's going on now. What are the stories we need to listen to? And with what's happening with immigration, you know, that's a major issue right now with our government. This past year, I actually just really delved in and learned more about what took place with the Japanese American internment camps. Of course, I knew that they took place, but I didn't know all of the significance of it. I didn't know the ramifications. I didn't know all of the pain, honestly, that occurred. At that time, the dean of students of Fuller Theological Seminary, that's where I attend, I'm in grad school there, he shared the story with me. And here's the connecting point. The connecting point is that someone who was living in those internment camps, she actually helped with getting appropriations for Japanese Americans, those who had been interned. She also connected with the Black movement during the Civil Rights Movement, Yuri Kochiyama. She had lived in the internment camp with her family. After she gotten out, she's fighting for rights of Japanese Americans, fighting for some type of resolve. And she connects with Malcolm X in the Black Power movement, also trying to help African Americans get more type of resolution, get some type of assistance. So there's a picture, there's an iconic picture that was in Life magazine, I think it was also in Time, where Yuri Kochiyama is there with Malcolm X, actually, as he's there on the ballroom floor, he's murdered. He's been shot. She's holding his head. So I want to include that connecting point. Really, the whole idea, and I will bring more of this out in the production, of while we are fighting for our own cause, while we are trying to advance our own people, taking the time to hear someone else's story, taking the time to help someone out with their cause. That's what we're pushing in this production.
Well, let's bring Steve Yamaguchi on. Steve, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thanks for coming on. Your mom was in that famous picture of Malcolm X as...
That's not his mother.
Oh, I'm sorry. Actually,
that's okay. The person in the picture is Yuri Kochiyama, who was also in an internment camp. But Steve Yamaguchi, his mother and his father, they were in camps as well.
Okay, and I'm sorry I got that wrong. Steve, talk about your parents for a moment. What happened to them?
Thanks, Rob. My parents were both born in California. Their parents came from Japan in the early 1900s. But when my parents were teenagers in 1942... in the hysteria after the bombing of Pearl Harbor in December 41, my parents were part of the population from the West Coast of Japanese Americans who had to go to internment camps. There were about 280,000 people, Japanese Americans, who were displaced from California, but 120,000 of them had nowhere to go. They knew no one else outside of the West, so they went to prison camps for the duration of war. And my father went to one of the camps that was in southeast Arizona at Gila River. So he lived in a camp behind barbed wire, actually on the Pima Indian Reservation, out in the desert. And my mother, who lived in the Los Angeles Harbor area, was taken immediately from the harbor area. And she actually lived in the horse stalls at the Santa Anita racetrack here in Southern California for 6 months until her camp was completed. And when that prison camp was completed in Arkansas, she was shipped by train with her family to Jerome, Arkansas. And she was one of the first people to be incarcerated and one of the very last to be released on the last day.
What were the conditions like in those camps?
Well, the camps were very sparse. They were surrounded by barbed wire. The barracks were hastily constructed. In the case of the Jerome, Arkansas camp, they were made from local wood and was green when they were built. So as the buildings aged, they leaked air. The people were in barracks and ate in mess halls and had bathrooms, had latrines that my mother recalls there were no dividers between the toilets and no partitions between showers. And for Japanese American people, that was very humiliating. And they ate food that was prepared by the Wartime Relocation Authority staff, not Japanese food, and not eating in family units either anymore, but eating in large mess halls. So children roamed around and adults ate together, but the structure of the family unit that was very important in Japanese American culture also was really broken down during camp, and the role of parents was dramatically altered in the Japanese home. But it was pretty sparse. My father's camp in Arizona had barbed wire around it, but actually people did sneak in and out of camp. Sometimes it would go off into the country and hike around. Some would sneak off to try to fish because there really was nowhere for them to go. If they went into town, they would be easily spotted and taken back to camp. So, but it was very sparse. People were given jobs, some farming. The average income was about, I believe it was about $12 to $13 a month. My grandfather was a fire truck driver, and he had a, I believe it was a $15 a month job. I think it was one of the highest paying jobs.
What did your family give up? They were taken away by force and put in these concentration camps and these internment camps. What did your family give up? What were they doing on the outside?
Yeah, they both of my parents' families were farming. My father was in Northern California. My mother was in Southern California. And so they had a farm. They had a barn, a house, a tractor, truck, car. House full of goods, and they had to leave everything behind and they could only take what they could carry in their arms, and some things were contraband also, silverware, electrical things, but so they just had to walk away from everything. In some cases, people had a little more notice. In my mother's case, because she lived in the L.A. Harbor area, it was considered militarily sensitive, and so they wanted those people out of there right away. So my mother had, as I recall, it was 48 hours notice, and they had to show up ready to go to camp, and they were taken to the horse stalls. But because they had to leave everything quickly, some people tried to sell things off, and but they didn't. They got pennies on the dollar because their neighbors knew that they had no options. So some people sold their things for hardly any cash, and some people just left them, abandoned them, and they had neighbors just waiting on the street as they had to leave their home so that the neighbors could go in and loot their homes. And my grandfather did a very unusual thing, that he decided he wasn't going to sell it and take pennies, but he was actually going to give it to his Mexican farm worker. And so my grandfather, I think in a brilliant move of kindness, helped a young Mexican-American family get started by just giving him the farm. But Japanese-American people could not own property, so they didn't own the land itself. And the reason they couldn't
hold property because that was the local law. There were local laws against Japanese Americans owning property?
No, it was because there's history that goes behind this, that in the late 19th century, after the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad and the overabundance of Chinese labor in California, there was anti-Chinese legislation that forbade any further immigration from China. So in the early 20th century, when there was a desire to have some cheap Asian labor, and because of changes in society in Japan, as it was westernizing, there were people in Japan who could come here, but they weren't Chinese. And that was when my grandparents came. But then in 1924, there was a restriction against all Asian immigration. And there was also a ban against naturalization. So my grandparents actually could not be naturalized until 1954. And so because they couldn't be naturalized, they couldn't be citizens, so they couldn't own property. So so they were not allowed to own property because they were not U.S. citizens.
We're talking with Steve Yamaguchi, who will take part in the play The Sounds of the Civil Rights Movement, The Power of Song, which takes place at the Palladium Theater this weekend, January 7th and January 8th. The January 7th show is at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m., and the January 8th show is at 7 p.m. September, let me go back to you. I want to play a little bit of this song that you've provided, and that is a song about the... the Japanese American experience. We are the children. Can you set this up for us?
I sure can. So when Steve was sharing with us this story, remember that day in the office, it just struck me that we needed to include this in the production. And if I'm going to include it in the production, it's got to be, there's got to be a song, you know. Certainly whenever people are in a place of struggle, music always rises out of that. Some of the best, some of the most powerful music rises out. So I knew that there were going to be songs out there that were either written in the camps or that were inspired by the experiences of the camps. So that's this one of these songs that we're sharing right now. And Steve and Junko, another Japanese American, she's going to come in. They're going to share this song with us this weekend.
Here is We Are the Children. You're listening to WMNF 88.5 FM. The song We Are the Children, you can see that on an album called A Grain of Sand, Music for the Struggle by Asians in America. It's on Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. And let me just go back to Steve for a moment. Steve, was your family ever made whole? Did things ever, was everything restored to you that was owed to you? Or what happened to your family?
Well, I would say not really, Rob. Although there was a token act in 1988, but prior to 1988, people were released from camp. When my mother was released from camp at the end of war, they were given $25 and a ticket to go anywhere they wanted. But they didn't have anywhere to go, so they went to live in a barn in Northern California until they could work their way back to the L.A. area. But in the so there was no kind of redress or reparation of any kind, and the America that they were released back into was really very hostile. Even though they were United States citizens, of the 120,000 people incarcerated, 80,000 were U.S. citizens, and the other 40,000 were here but were not allowed to be naturalized. They were the immigrants. But in 1988, there was a redress movement that was. The result of people of my generation, really, baby boomers born after the war, who had become lawyers by the 60s and worked to take up a case that helped to reverse some decisions made earlier and reveal that the government had understood that there was no military value in the incarceration, and it really motivated by political failure and economic motivation in the agriculture industry. And so in 1988, President Reagan signed signed an act that was sometimes called the Redress Bill that did provide a letter of apology from the United States government, acknowledging that what was done was a mistake. And I think that was probably the most important thing to restore my family, I think, and the Japanese-American community. There was also a token $20,000 check that was given to each survivor who was still alive at the time of the bill signing in 1988. But it really was that movement from the late 60s into the 80s of young Asian Americans becoming activated to work and fight for civil rights that led to that political result in 88, but also produced that song in the 70s that September found to have in the show.
And September, let me go back to you for just a moment. We talked about nonviolence, and there's so many issues that we've raised here, issues raised by Steve that we just don't have time to go into. But forgive me for doing such a short job on this. But the idea of nonviolence, I mean, today people are concerned about a lot of things. Families are being forcefully repatriated to places like Honduras and El Salvador and Mexico. There's people who are complaining, rightly so, that the issue of police brutality is not being addressed here in the U.S. The police shoot people. A lot of African-American people are shot and killed. And there's no redress. The families feel that justice isn't served. Is nonviolence still relevant, do you think?
I think nonviolence, yeah, it still has to be relevant. And it really still has to be our choice. because there's still more power in numbers with nonviolence. There are sects that are choosing to be violent. You know, when you even look at what took place in Charlottesville, there's, you know, the sect of Antifa, those who do fight back, and they were actually protecting those who are being nonviolent.
In Charlottesville.
We witnessed that. I personally don't have any commentary against them, but what I can speak of is I am still in favor of nonviolence, and I think that's the way to go. I think many scholars, that's what they're sharing. I heard a lecture by Willie Jennings a couple months ago, and he was also strongly advocating for nonviolence. As a people, that's how we're going to have our greatest move forward collectively. The long and the short of it.
Steve, did you want to add to that?
Well, I agree with September. I think that the movement has a long history and ultimately wins. I think that more violent, extreme expressions do flame out. I'm completely with September and appreciate so much this production that she does, and I'm so grateful for her extending her vision to include new stories, local stories, and even including this story of Japanese America.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. Steve, if people want to find out more about the Japanese-American experience that your parents went through and that your grandfather went through, is there a good website or a good book that you could recommend?
The book that I would recommend would be Infamy by Richard Reeves. Richard Reeves, the biographer, journalist, called Infamy, The Shocking Story of the Japanese-American Internment in World War II. And I think Richard Reeves' book is an excellent and recent summation of a lot of what happened. A website is, it's densho.org, densho.org. And it's a website of history devoted to the Japanese-American story, and it's very, very well done.
All right. Steve Yamaguchi, thank you so much for coming on WMNF. Ivan, again, the play is this weekend, The Sounds of the Civil Rights Movement, The Power of Song. It's at the Palladium this weekend.
This weekend, tickets are free. The production is a gift to the community as part, again, of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day of Service. We have, and not just St. Petersburg, we have a music contest that we did for kids K through 12, both Pinellas and Hillsborough counties. And we have winners, three winners, one from Hillsborough, two from Pinellas. So folks should come out and support their community.
This Sunday at 3 p.m. and this Sunday at 7 p.m. and also Monday at 7 p.m. And you're asking people to bring food too, because you're helping a food bank.
That's right. We partner with the Everyday Hero Project. Last year, the effort generated 1,700 pounds of food.
Wow.
With donation locations around the area. The production is one of those donation locations. Bring a non-perishable food item and to help restock the local food banks.
We're going to go out with one of the anthems of the Civil Rights Movement performed by Harry Belafonte. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. And by the way, if you want to find out more about the play this Sunday and Monday, call 727-822-3590. Here's O Freedom, Harry Belafonte, who's going to be speaking at USF later on this year. And Ivan, in September, thank you so much.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. We appreciate the support.
Thank you.
Great
thank
to
you.
See you.
Home to my Lord and be free. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in a marked grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Everybody! Oh, freedom! Oh, freedom! Sing it, sister!
Harry Belafonte, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. This is Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, is it possible to have an economic movement that takes a radically different approach to federal spending and the federal deficit, that we shouldn't be so concerned about the federal deficit? There is a movement out there that believes that higher levels of federal spending are possible without injuring the economy. It's called Modern Monetary Theory. And there's a movement here in Tampa to spread the word about this. And our guests are Brian Schatz and Scott Ferguson. Brian is a local community activist, and Scott is a professor at USF. And Brian and Scott, welcome to WMNF. Great to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming by. So let me ask you, what is modern monetary theory?
Modern monetary theory is an analysis of how money works for over the last 4,000 years. It is an analysis of all countries, and it's a state theory. In other words, a country or a state has the wish to have some sort of device to exchange, and that's its essence.
And so what is it, when it comes to things like spending and the deficit, what are the what does modern monetary theory say about spending and the federal deficit?
Well, this is where most get it backwards. So the federal government, which is sovereign, and it has the ability to be the monopoly currency issuer, they're the ones that have our free-floating, non-convertible, non-pegged currency. It's not pegged to gold. It's not pegged to someone else's currency, free-floating. They're the ones in Congress that write the rules, make a spending bill, and that spending bill then gets signed or not signed by the president. And with that monetary amount, the Federal Reserve marks up the account and places it into the Treasury, and then the money gets spent. that's how new money gets issued into our economy. And taxes actually are the removing machine. They actually delete it. So how people think, they think that the economic system, you need the people to make the money and then give it to the government. That's backward. Almost everyone thinks that. And no, it's the government that issues the currency and taxes remove it.
So it starts, money starts with the government.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay. We're talking about modern monetary theory, and our guests are Brian Schatz and Scott Ferguson, and you guys want to have a movement about this. You want to get people excited about this idea, right?
Oh, my gosh. You know, when I first heard this, I thought it was kind of loopy, and because everybody's heard this their whole life. They all think the silly thing that, yes, we need to pay our taxes so the government can spend it.
Yeah, I think I'm paying my taxes this year so the government can spend that money next year.
That's what people think, but it's not the truth. And when I had the eureka moment and it lights and bells went off in my mind, I thought, well, then we can now open up this policy space, meaning the government can actually spend for the Commonwealth what we actually want, you know. All kinds of groups want different things.
So if we want free healthcare and if we want free college tuition and if we want an infrastructure program, you're saying there's money there to do it?
As long as four things are kept. You have to watch for inflation. You have to have an educated populace that's able and willing to work. You have to have a core infrastructure that actually can be built upon. And you have to make sure that the there's one other thing, and I'll look at my notes, but go ahead, Scott, you take it.
Okay, where to pick up?
Yeah.
So, the upshot here is that what MMT tells us is that money is not a private, finite exchange relationship between private households and firms, but instead it is a boundless public utility, right? So it's boundless. There's really no limit, at least when it comes to numerical amounts. It belongs to the public. We usually don't think of it in this way, but money, even when issued by private banks, are all state chartered banks, right? And it's a utility. It should be something that is used for and by the people.
So just like electricity, if we want more electricity, you burn more coal or more nuclear or more solar, and you put more electricity in the system. Is that the way you think money works? If
yes.
You want more money, you just print more money?
Yes, with one crucial difference. There is a finite amount of energy that we can create.
And that was my last point, and the most critical one, because Rob knows me and a lot of the community knows me as being an environmentalist. And that's our major restriction, is the real, resilient, sustainable resources. We just can't go crazy if we don't have enough of those. So those are the four restrictions.
Now, let me go back, just so folks get an idea of where this stands. We're talking about modern monetary theory with Brian Schatz and Scott Ferguson, who are trying to create a local movement, I think it's fair to say. There's libertarianism that essentially thinks that, you know, all government is evil because it takes away our freedom. And so the best society is a society in which government is very small. So libertarians think that the free market is invisible and it's magical. And whatever problem that we have in the world can be solved by the free market. Are you guys in any way on the libertarian side of things? Just so people understand.
I am not.
Okay.
I am not either. They actually help make it worse because their theory is based on Austrian school and Chicago school. And this is the problem in most economic schools, is they're teaching the concepts that we're still stuck on the gold standard, and they want us to go back to it.
And on the other side, there's a Keynesian theory that got us through the Depression and through World War II. Was everybody that was in FDR's administration really subscribed to this? And that is, if you put the right amount of public money invested into things like healthcare and roads and the military, you're going to get a return. As long as you don't overspend, you're not going to create inflation. So the Keynesians think that during depressions, for instance, you want to prime the pump and you want to add more money to the economy, and mainly through government spending, although some Keynesians think tax cuts are good too. But so are you on the Keynesian side?
Somewhat. The Keynesianism that took off in the United States with the FDR administration and after throughout mid-century tended to rely actually on tax cuts and temporary short-term stimulus, whereas what modern monetary theory argues for would be a permanent commitment to counter-cyclical spending and programs. And at the center of this would be a federally funded, locally organized job guarantee, which would essentially provide public works at all kinds of levels, city, county, state, and the federal level itself, to keep people employed and to keep our economy and our country moving ahead.
Do you think that, is your idea that you would put a lot of money into the economy to create this job program, to create maybe free college for all, to create a healthcare system, an infrastructure system, so the federal government would spend tens of trillions, maybe more dollars than it does now?
Well,
is that right?
To circle around where some of these ideas came from, Bernie Sanders had Stephanie Kelton as his economic advisor during his campaign and when he was the budget chair of the Congress.
And is she a big proponent of modern monetary theory?
Absolutely. If anybody really wants to whet their appetite on this, just type in Stephanie Kelton, spelled with a K, K-E-L-T-O-N, into YouTube and listen to her lectures. You will eventually have that eureka, aha moment that I had, and it will turn your whole outlook, your paradigm will change. Talking about Keynes earlier, a gentleman that was his colleague, Beardsley Rummel, this gentleman actually wrote a paper in 1946 saying tax revenue is basically obsolete.
Right. Taxes for revenue
are obsolete.
Why did he say that?
Because he actually understood what we're telling you right now is the economy is something that the government, when you open up your wallet and you look at the dollar bill, it doesn't say it comes from the private sector. It comes from the public sector, our government. It's signed by the Treasury. That's where new money comes from, and you have to remove some of it in order to control inflation, and that is the best safety valve on inflation.
One way of thinking about this is to compare it to compare the federal government to a scorekeeper at a sports match. So when we go to a football game, we do not ask the referee, well, hey, where are you going to get all the points that you need to award in this upcoming game? We don't ask him that, and then he does not reply, well, I'll borrow it from the top team in the league because they have so many points, and then we can redistribute them. This is the best way to think about the federal government. It's a scorekeeper. As one of the modern monetary theorists, Warren Moser, will say, the federal government neither has nor does not have money. It simply is the scorekeeper, and it can mark up numbers on the spreadsheet or mark them down.
Okay, well, I want to get to this question of inflation. Before we do, our phone number, 813-239-9663. And if you've got a question for our guests about modern monetary theory, you can call us up, 813-239-9663, or email us at dj@wmnf.org. Okay, so if like points at a ball game are potentially infinite, money is potentially infinite.
Yes.
But so if you spend a lot of money, though, the economic theorists say you're going to create inflation, that if you spend more money than you have, and if your government goes deeply into debt, then other countries around the world and other investors around the world will look at your currency and say, well, they're deeply in debt. They won't be able to pay their debt. We don't trust their currency, so we're going to get rid of your dollars, for instance, if that's...
So there's many things that we can say in response to this. One thing that I'll say is I think that we have to be careful about the quality of the spending? Are we talking about public works that do environmental retrofitting that create that creates jobs and production and demand and takes care of people and takes care of our environment? That kind of spending is not going to be inflationary. If we just have, you know, willy-nilly spending on you know, silly projects that are, you know, corrupt and charging millions of dollars for hammers and nails, yeah, that's going to be inflationary, and that's not a good idea. Another thing that I like to say is that we have it precisely backwards. We have an economy that is running under capacity.
Mm-hmm.
By what logic is the U.S. dollar worth more when it is running at under capacity?
And when you say under capacity, why do you say that?
I say that because we have millions and millions of people who are unemployed and underemployed.
There's 50% of our population that is either poor or near poor. That's wrong. That's not a good economy.
And so that is, those folks are underperforming. They're under capacity. If we put those low income folks or poor folks to work,
yeah, we educated them and they're
wanted jobs.
Yeah, we've educated them and they're very useful and they could be put to work. And that's why a policy prescription. I want to make sure you understand. There's two sides. There's a policy prescriptive side to modern monetary theory, which all economists have, and then there's the analysis side
and the descriptive side. Correct.
Yeah. And yeah. The descriptive side is, and some people say, oh, it's just a theory of yours. Should we implement it? No, this is what's going on. It's not, we don't implement it. We're looking at it.
What are you trying to do? You're trying to start a local movement. That's how I introduced you. Is that right? You're trying to get
absolutely
other people interested and maybe start a club or a discussion group? Or
absolutely. Like DSA just in Truth Out yesterday.
This is the Democratic Socialists of America?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's... Scott knows these two folks. These are, why don't you mention their names in the Truth Out article, Alex and Sean. I think it's Sean Keith and Alexander Kalatrinas. They wrote an article called Modern Monetary Theory, How Do We Pay for It? And it's fabulous that this is getting out. That's the main question.
They have ideas about how you can pay for it, how it's not inflationary.
Absolutely. So now the Democratic Socialists are adopting, hopefully, modern monetary theory, and we want all.
You have to understand, this is actually spreading like wildfire all over the place.
Right.
And in all kinds of camps, and between people who don't necessarily always get along. Something else that you should know is that Stephanie Kelton hasn't just worked with Bernie Sanders. Stephanie Kelton has been all over Washington, D.C., and she's been advising many, many, many Democrats.
She was on the Senate Budget Committee for a while.
Yes.
You know, and I saw, I read an article that's from this year in the Nation magazine, said that, or 2017 in the Nation magazine, she showed up for a conference in Italy, and it was packed with people who wanted to hear about this. But, you know, I was looking back at an old Paul Krugman column from 2011, and he was very skeptical about this. He says he thinks this idea would cause inflation. If the federal government were to say, okay, we can spend whatever we need to build all the roads, all the bridges, hire all those, that percent of the 4% who are unemployed who want jobs, that would be inflationary, says Krugman.
He is what we call a Keynesian, and MMTers are post-Keynesians. They're taking it many steps further. In other words, there's some differences.
Yeah, okay, well, how can people hook up with you? Because we're getting down to the end, and I want to take some phone calls, but if you're trying to start the movement, you know, how can people reach you?
Well, the easy way for me, since my name is exactly spelled like the senator in Hawaii, Brian Schatz, S-C-H-A-T-Z, friend me on Facebook. I will love to hook you up into all the right areas in Facebook where you can understand this. For Scott?
I have a university email address, sferguson@usf.edu. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Videotroph, V-I-D-E-O-T-R-O-P-H.
Now, neither of you is an economist. Brian, you're a small business person.
I'm a small business person.
You should be a Republican. Isn't that what they say?
That's what they say. Wouldn't that be funny? You know, this has been said as one of the answers that Stephanie got during one of her talks, and the question was, well, why don't these politicians talk about this? Why are the politicians actually going along with the wrong theory? And she says, you need to have their backs. If they come out with this, they're going to seem loopy and kooky, and they don't want to spill the beans. So that's our mission. Scott and I feel like we want to have their backs and say, no, 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 you can say this. A lot of people agree with you, so this is our goal.
And I'm trying to do this in the humanities and academia, is kind of spreading the word through that channel.
How did you find out about it, Scott?
A podcast, actually.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let's take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663, and our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And let's go to Chris in St. Pete. Chris, what's your question for Brian and Scott?
Well, what do you think of neither von Mises School or Chicago School or Keynesian economics, but because the government is so prone to rigging the economy, issuing our own by what I think is the most dynamic would be community currencies, but also there are time banks, barter networks, cooperatives, swap shops, and community gardens that I know that's not economic, but it's a good way to get fresh energy. And with these, we can defeat usury. We don't have to wait for the politicians to reform economics, and we can trend towards a gifting society once we can realize that as our standard of live, as our technology increases, so should our standard of living. And what do you think of the idea that we're not really in an inflationary period, but rather deflationary, because both inflation and deflation make prices increase. With inflation, you have empty store shelves where people will go out and buy all they can before the prices rise again. But deflation, the prices rise because the currency or value.
Okay, all right. Well, Chris, there's a lot there. So let's try to chew on some of that. What do you think about just going to this idea of community currency, community gardens, bartering that Chris suggested?
So MMT wants to say that there's, especially Warren Mosler and all the higher...
Mosler is an economist?
Mosler's the father of it. He's the one who wrote a book long ago called Mosler Economics that then got turned into soft currency economics, and then it became modern monetary theory. So he introduced some ideas. We won't discuss them here, but to answer the caller's question is, they're saying that there's nothing wrong with the way the system is set up. It's just the way we've been, I don't know, you can say brainwashed, but we have been culturally accustomed to the wrong thinking of how taxes and federal spending works. So we have 535 people. This is my goal, Rob. My goal is there's 535 people, 100 are in Senate and 435 in Congress. They're the ones that are the control valve on how money is spent. They are the ones we need to educate and implore and get into their offices or wherever. However, to let them know you need to spend for the Commonwealth. This idea of creating wealth inequality for these last 40 years is over.
You know, a question I always ask libertarians when they're on here on WMNF, I say, which country has tried this? So the same question goes to you. Which country has tried modern monetary theory?
Well, All of them. They all do it. We're all doing it right now. And plus...
Because they're deficit spending. Is that what you're saying?
So, and then the other thing, if you want to know about the... job guarantee, Argentina tried it in 2001, and it actually helped.
Well, when we hear these people saying that we're saddling our kids and grandkids and future generations with the debt that we're creating today, what do you say back?
Real quickly, I'd like to say everybody pays attention to the debt. The debt is accumulated year-to-year deficits. So the government spends, and what they don't tax back is the deficit. So if you add those all up, we're $20 trillion right now. So that's one side of the balance sheet. So every person who's an accounting person knows there's another side of the balance sheet. There's an asset, and that is $20 trillion in the private sector. We're using that to do commerce, to save, and to pay our taxes. So for everybody to keep looking at the debt and deficit, they're not looking at the other side of the balance sheet. It's how the money's being spent that's wrong.
And the currency issuer, at least a sovereign one, like the United States, and if we're going to talk about Greece or Spain, that's a different situation, a sovereign currency issuer can always meet its debt obligations. How? Today, it's about hitting keystrokes on a computer. That's how it happens.
All right. Well, the theory is called modern monetary theory. We've been discussing it with Brian Schatz and Scott Ferguson. And Brian and Scott, welcome. Thank you for coming on WMNF.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
If you want to comment about today's show, call us up, 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play your comment.